Good afternoon. Thank you very much for these kind words of introduction, in particular for the chemistry in it. I always appreciate hearing what I've done in the past. Of course, I would like to continue with that and switching to now to a chemistry talk, but since I promised to, well, do a little bit of chemistry, but not real chemistry, only related to chemistry, I also stick to what I've prepared. I also want to thank very much Arno de Kemp and the organizers of this conference for inviting me to this, for giving the guest lecture tonight. When I was informed of this invitation, I was surprised and I was very honored, of course, to have the opportunity to address such a distinguished audience. But then again, it also made me a bit of heartache. What is it that I can tell you? The relationship between learned societies and scientific publishing is indeed multifaceted, but it, in particular for an audience like you, it contains, of course, a lot of truisms. So I decided to try to pick some points which I think are of importance in this respect. And what I'm trying to speak to you is summarized here in this overview. I want to start out by just telling you where I'm coming from, to give you a little bit of a background information on my society, also to lay the field for what learned societies are, because as I will show you in a minute, I think we are a pretty good example, and there are many other societies with very, very similar targets and goals. I will very briefly mentioning the very close relationship that learned societies and scientific publishing enjoy for centuries, actually, and will then go into more the field I feel at home at, because of course what I will be talking to you will be mostly coming from the point of view of a chemist and not of a sort of general scientist, and many of the things have a chemistry have a connection to chemistry. So I will then go on to explaining you a little bit why the Gesellschaft Deutscher Chemiker has a long tradition when it comes to publishing. I will tell you a little bit about the recent history of that tradition, which has, as I would say, some very interesting peculiarities in it. Among those is, for example, that what I here mentioned explicitly, the ChemPubStock Europe story, which I think is a great success story. And then we'll go on and have a brief excourse on the publishing landscape as we see it in chemistry, and of course what the role of the learned societies are in particular in chemistry, because I think chemistry is here maybe not an extremely special case, but it certainly is a special case, because as I will show you, the learned societies do play a significant role when it comes to publishing, in particular in chemistry. Of course, when I'm speaking here at the APE conference, I cannot leave out open access. We heard already a lot of open access this morning and this afternoon, and I learned a lot, and I must say I was very impressed by many of the things that I've heard. But I also want to address some of the points which are of importance to us when it comes to open access. Here we will also see some of the differences between the disciplines, in particular, of course, where chemistry is different from, say, biology, life sciences, or physics. One of the differences is that I don't think that there has ever been a paper in chemistry with almost 3,000 authors. And after that, I will sum up and give you some conclusions. So, let me introduce you to the Gesellschaft Deutscher Chemiker, or the German Chemical Society. We are the largest chemical society in continental Europe. Unfortunately, I always have to add here continental, because our friends from the Royal Society of Chemistry in the UK are still bigger, for reasons I could now elaborate on, but which I will not do. And we are, as most of the learned societies are, a not-for-profit registered charity. Our tradition goes back almost 150 years. The first predecessor organization was founded in 1867, actually here in Berlin, not far from this place, as the Deutsche Chemische Gesellschaft. And 1867 was a time when chemistry really had a very large development, very influential development in this country. So it was not a surprise that this society was founded at this time. And it consisted mostly of members coming from academia. Sometime later, actually 20 years later, a second organization was founded, which had the name of Verein Deutscher Chemiker. If I would translate both into English, they're about the same. Here the difference is, since the chemical industry at that time also began to become a very important industrial sector in Imperial Germany at that time, the industrial chemists thought they need an organization of their own, and that was exactly this organization. So this was an organization with members mostly coming from industry. After World War II, these two organizations ceased to exist and were refounded as one organization in 1949, as then the Gesellschaft Deutscher Chemiker. And if you are a mathematician, you will realize that the new name is a linear combination of the two old names. Right now, we have around 30,000 members. Actually, this year, we hit for the first time, we have more than 30,000 members, which are coming now not from either industry or academia, but we are uniting chemistry or chemists wherever they work, be it in academia, be it in industry, or be it in many other areas. And we enjoy a growth in membership now, I think, for the 6 or 7 years in a row. So I'm pretty optimistic that our organization will have a bright future also in the years to come. We are not only an organization of individual members, we also have about 200 corporate and institutional members. Institutional members are, in many instances, libraries. And, of course, the corporate members are the major chemical companies in this country. I'm coming from Frankfurt, where we have our headquarters where we employ about 50 plus people who do all the things that our members want us to do, and some of the things I will also come back later. From an organizational point of view, the society is organized in one dimension when it comes to the sub-disciplines of chemistry. So we have about 30 technical divisions, be it organic chemistry, inorganic chemistry, electrochemistry, you name it. And on the other dimension, the regional dimension, you will find local sections of the GDCH at, I would say, all places and locations in Germany where chemistry plays a role, be it because there is a university, be it because there is a research institute, or because there is a big company site. One of the important things is that since 15 years now, we also have a special organization for student members, which is called Jungchemiker Forum, and also they organize regionally, and about 40 of these regional Jungchemiker Forum exist right now. That this number is smaller than the number of the regular local sections is a consequence of the much higher dynamics that you have when it comes to the younger generation. Sometimes at a certain university, there are none who are interested in doing something like this, so it stops existing, and then 2 years later, they come back. And of course, that in many of the industrial sites, there is no critical mass in these young people. What do we do? I told you we have about 50 people that do something, but what is it that they do? And of course, our main task is advancing chemistry. We are there to provide services to the chemical community, and that is organization of conferences and scientific meetings. That is platforms for exchange, for scientific exchange, be it in the technical divisions or also in the local sections. Then, of course, it's more in an interdisciplinary area. We do career support for our members. We offer continuing education classes or continuing professional development. That's what CPD is standing for. We offer career advice. We offer job service and other services. Of course, we are also trying to influence the policymakers when it comes to science policy, when it comes to educational reforms and things like that. We, together with similar organizations, are trying to pave the way so that the science is not completely forgotten. And very important also is the is addressing the general public. I don't know how many of you remembered that in 2011 we had the International Year of Chemistry. That was something that, of course, also for our organization was a very important year. Teacher training, I also want to mention here, because we all know only if we have well-educated students, and that also applies to, of course, high schools and other schools, we will have, on the one hand, the qualified workers in the industries, but also we need a certain basic knowledge of the sciences for the political discourse, because you only can discuss something if you understand at least a little bit about what the discussion is going on. And I just remember the discussion that we have right now about energy and other things, which are highly dominated by scientific arguments. And that's the reason why I'm here, I think. We are also active when it comes to publication of scientific journals. And that, of course, is the point that I will come back to you in more detail. So I can probably summarize this, that the activities that we do are all there to provide service to our community, and that's also why members are members in our society and are willing to pay their membership dues, because they know that what we do is good for the scientific community. This is nothing very special. There are many examples of that, and I said they're here, therefore here. I think we are really a typical learned society, and I know that representatives of other learned societies are also here in the audience, and I think most of the points that I have mentioned here are also on the agendas of these other scientific societies. So, now you know what the Gesellschaft Deutscher Chemiker is and what we are doing. Now I jumped just a little bit to get closer to the point of my talk, and that is learned societies and the origin of and scientific publishing, and I will jump back to the origin of scientific publishing. I think it's clear that right from the beginning, all learned societies were committed to supporting scientific exchange. Actually, that was one of the reasons why these societies came into being in the first place, because science needs communication and exchange with peers. And that, of course, is done usually through platforms, and organizations like ours are the ones who are offering this. In the beginning, this communication was mainly through letters and books, and of course, since most of this was local, also through meetings. And during the years, books became inappropriate, in particular in the natural sciences, just because the time it cost to prepare a book and to distribute it was much too long for the short-lived world of sciences. And letters, which usually were a sort of a bilateral kind of correspondence, they evolved in the longhand then into scientific journals. And actually, that it was a scientific societies which generated all this, what we are now call academic publishing, and that, and why we are sitting here. And you probably know that in 1665, the first scientific journal was founded by the Royal Society in London, only two or three years after the Royal Society was founded, because here it was very clear there is a demand for something like this. This then went on, and by the end of the 18th century, there were around 100 scientific journals. Most of these journals, if not all of them, were still multidisciplinary. Great service, thank you.
Good to serve you.
And also the learned societies behind them were usually multidisciplinary societies, because only later than the 19th centuries, discipline-oriented societies came into being. This piece of information that I wrote here, the first commercial journal, according to Wikipedia, that was the only source I found any information about this, is here given as a philosophical magazine. Interesting, also here, everything is philosophical. From 1798, I have to admit, I don't know how much I can trust this information, but I thought I should mention it anyway. Then in the 19th century, in particular, in the second half of the 19th century, science became much broader, and there was a need of specializing. So the science, scientific discipline societies developed. Typically, they all have had journals. In chemistry, this started in the 1840s with the foundation of the Chemical Society in London. A few years later, the Société Chimique in Paris was founded, and then I just showed you that in 1867, also in Germany, the first Chemical Society was founded. And as I said, they all had their own journals, and these journals served mainly three purposes, which I think still is true today. That is, they record the information, to disseminate that information, and last but certainly not least, to confer prestige to the author. And these purposes are still valid and are still among the main motivations for learned societies why they are active in publishing. And the commercial aspects of this were, at least in the beginnings, only of minor importance. Actually, as far as I have read, the philosophical transactions, for example, were a economic disaster in the first years, and I think many of the other early journals had a similar fate. This is sort of the general picture. Now let me come back to my society and give you a short overview of publication developed within the German Chemical Society. I told you 1867 it was founded. A year later, the journal was created, Berichte der Deutschen Chemischen Gesellschaft, which, by the way, still exists, even though under a different name. I will come back to that. 20 years later, as the other organization was founded, also that organization created a journal which has the name, or had the name, Zeitschrift für Angewandte Chemie. Without the Zeitschrift für, it still exists under the title Angewandte Chemie and is our flagship journal today. In 1921, the two chemical societies joined together with the back then Association of the Chemical Industry in Germany to establish its own publishing house, because they realized we want to be independent from the commercial publishers who did that publishing service until then for these organizations. And Verlag Chemie was founded, Verlag Chemie, which today is a part of John Wiley & Sons and is Wiley VCH, located in Weinheim. In 1961, another interesting development happened. Until then, all our journals were published in German, which I think was, from the tradition here, it was well understood. Also because in the early, or in the first half of the 20th century, the lingua franca in chemistry was not English, or was not only English, but it was at least to the same extent also German. There were, for example, mandatory German classes for each chemistry student in the United States. So it was not a big problem that German literature was also written in German. That, of course, then changed, in particular after the Second World War. And in 1861, our society decided to have a English-speaking version of Angewandte Chemie, but keeping the German version. And that, of course, is very interesting. We still do have the German version. We still publish both versions parallel to each other, which, from the scientific point of view, is completely unnecessary, because, of course, every German scientist, every German chemist very well understands the English version of Angewandte Chemie and all the other literatures in English. We nevertheless are convinced that this is very important to have a platform where we are able to keep this sort of the chemistry language in German also up to date. Because, of course, if you talk to the public, you don't speak to them in English. If you talk in the lab to your lab technician, you're not talking English with him or with her, but German. So we need a chemistry language which is up to date and which is able to address all the new and current developments, and that is the reason why we kept the German edition. Then there are several European journals which have been founded, and I don't go into detail here because I will come back to this in a few minutes. I mentioned here the launch of analytical and bioanalytical chemistry because that's so far interesting. This is the only scientific journal that we do not publish with our old publishing partner, Weyler-VCH, but for reasons which have something to do with the predecessor journal of analytical and bioanalytical chemistry. This is being published together with Springer Verlag. ChemPubSoc Europe is something I will elaborate on a bit later, and all these other journals, ex-chem journals, are part of this ChemPubSoc Europe story. I should say that in 2002, our society sold its last shares that we still had in VCH, or Wiley-VCH already at that time, so now we have no ownership in that publishing house anymore. And something I will also come back to a bit later is chemistry open, so there's also an open access activity going on. So in total, we have now a portfolio of around 20 scientific journals, most of them in English, some still in German. These are not the journals which are sort of a pure scientific journals, but more addressing a general public or high school students, which of course then has to be in German. And we have built a strong cooperation with many publishing houses with who we work together. Wiley-VCH, of course, is a prime one because we share a 90-year joint history, or more than 90-year joint history, but also Springer, as I just mentioned, with this one journal, De Gruyter, which is publishing our membership journal, Thieme, with which we also have cooperation agreements, and others, and until a few years, I should have also mentioned here Elsevier, because for many years, Elsevier was our exclusive partner in the marketing of our database, not a journal, but a database. But then, after some years, we actually sold that database to Elsevier, so this relationship has ceased. Angewandte Chemie. I told you already, this is our flagship journal, and I want to spend a minute or two. I said already, it was founded a year after the Verein Deutscher Chemiker was founded. I also told you it is published parallel in German and English, and actually this earned us, or the editorial team, I should say, and the editor-in-chief, Peter Gülitz, is here among us, how to translate this? Culture Award for the German language, because this award committee recognized that we are advancing the science language German through this parallel publishing. This journal is one, if not the most successful or relevant journal in chemistry, apart from review journals, and I hope that the friends from the American Chemical Society and the Royal Society of Chemistry, who are here in the room, will not protest too much if I say this. It has a rejection rate of almost 80%, an impact factor which is the highest of all chemistry, general chemistry journals, of currently 13.455. It still has a strong connection to our society, even though all the publishing services are done through Wiley-VCH. And the graphics down there is just to show you the development of this journal, which I think is not very untypical from what other journals see, in particular if you see it, the green bars, which show that the importance of submissions from the Asian countries has increased significantly. 125 years of success, so let me just have here a little bit of a commercial. We are celebrating the 125 years of Angewandte Chemie in about 6 weeks' time here in Berlin at the Freie Universität with a very prominent symposium with three Nobel laureates, but also people who have nothing to do with chemistry, like one of the editors of Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, Frank Schirmacher, who we invited to sort of go also beyond chemistry when it comes to publishing. Learn Society Chemistry Publishing, where did we stand 20 years ago? We had many traditional journals by national chemical societies, but these journals, I'm not going into the details because I have to be finished by 18:15, is that correct? So I have to speed up a little bit. But I think the main point is there were many journals, but they were irrelevant. Almost all of them were irrelevant, and also economically they were a problem. So as a solution, we said, why not giving up these journals and creating pan-European journals instead? And it is hard to believe, but we really were able to convince our friends from France, Belgium, Switzerland, and so on, you see the number, you see the countries down there, to give up their national journals, as did we. For example, the Berichte der Chemischen Gesellschaft, which I mentioned in the beginning, has also been amalgamated into these new journals. So we have now a whole portfolio of European Chemistry Society owned and co-owned journals. And that, of course, has also led to a strong cooperation between these societies, which otherwise would not have been possible. So this is not only a publishing story, it is also a story of European cooperation and collaboration, which extends beyond the publishing. And I think here it was important that we were able to work together with Wiley VCH as sort of a neutral platform where we could do that. I think it would have been much more difficult if VCH would still have been GDCH owned, because then, of course, this would be sort of the German Chemical Society, which is taking over everything. And this, for example, we could prevent by this neutral platforms. So we have today 10 journals. And just to show you the development of this, if you look back, these are data or averages taken from the last volume of each of the journals which disappeared. The average impact factor was mere 0.85. And the total number of pages close to 12,000, and you see this has been developed into, I think, numbers which speak for themselves. And last but not least, of course, the economic side plays a big role here. In particular, if you look out at all the smaller societies that were involved, the royalties that we now receive from this are a significant source of income for these societies. This shows again just how the development, you see it started in the mid-90s, and we are still launching new journals. And one thing which I forgot to mention is that everyone is complaining that publishers are launching new journals, and so the number of journals is increasing, which makes it very difficult. This case is also here different, because the number of journals that disappeared is still larger as the number of journals that we created. That's what we call sustainable publishing, so that for the scientist, he or she has not to deal with a larger amount of journals, but only with more relevant journals, and I think this is for the benefit of chemistry. Publishing in chemistry is different, and I think it's particularly different from what we heard in the previous talk when I think about high-energy physics. First of all, we have a big difference, and that is that chemistry is not only a science. Chemistry is also an industry, which means, as in other sciences also, our authors are coming predominantly from academia or from science. The users, instead, also are coming to a significant part from the chemical and pharmaceutical industry. That has one of the consequences that a chemist knows very well, that information and access to that information has commercial value, which is, I think, different in high-energy physics. I don't think it's hard to earn money with the Higgs. It's also one of the reasons why databases are so important, because all this data has to be available in particular for companies. And again, this is a big difference to what you have shown us. Typically, we really have only small research units, say a PI plus two or three doctoral students, and that is it. You hardly have big cooperation, which of course then translates into the fact that there is less need for global networking. That then has led to the fact that in chemistry you hardly have a preprint culture. You also don't have preprint servers like Archive. This does not exist. Actually, Elsevier tried this a number of years ago with a preprint server exactly modeled after Archive, and they stopped it a couple of years later because in this 4 or 5 years of existence, I think they got less than 1,000 submissions, and the quality of these submissions was just terrible. So this is really a different culture. What is important, and when I come to open access, this is something I have to come back to, industry is an important customer for publishers, which is also different if you look at biology, physics, or other the sciences. And industry has specific requirements, which are also different from what in academia is important. Namely, this is the most important of these specific requirements, text mining. They need to have access to the data so that they can sort of on in a publishing or a platform which is publisher independent, more or less, can mine all the information, all the data that are around for a molecule or a substance they're interested in. Now let me spend a few minutes on how the publishing landscape looks like in chemistry. We have, I call it Big Five publishers, even though the list is made out of six. The reason is that we have the three commercial big ones, Elsevier, Wiley-Blackwell, and Springer, and we have two independent publishers from learned societies, that the American Chemical Society and the Royal Society of Chemistry. And then we have the ChemPubSoc Europe plus JDCH Publishing, which of course is part of Wiley, because Wiley is our prime publisher. So big five, but six individual components. If we now look how the market is being distributed, and these are data that Eva Wille from Wiley Funds VCH gave me, and I don't want to discuss the numbers in great detail. This should only be sort of give the order of magnitude. If you look at the number of articles, Elsevier has the largest share, followed by the American Chemical Society, and then the others. You can see it by yourself. Of course, if the real Wiley number would be the 10 plus 4. So the green spot where I said GDCH plus CPSE is a part of Wiley, but I just wanted to show you what our part here is. So this is when it comes to the number of articles. When I now look at the number of citations, the situation is different. Elsevier is about the same. However, you should note that the others, which was here 22, is now 11. So the cake here is in principle bigger. The ACS has made a significant jump, and also the green part here of the pie chart, which belongs to our journals, has become much bigger, and I've just summarized this here. If you look at quantity, the commercial publishers play an important role. If you look to citations, you see that the relevance usually is higher for the journals that are coming from the learned societies. About 45 of all citations quote society journals, which I think is a high number. I did not look into the other fields, but I would assume that in other fields this number is smaller. And of course, this has also led to a very helpful hierarchy of journals. That is, if you submit your paper, and you know it's an excellent paper, you of course send it first of all to the high quality interdisciplinary journals like Nature and Science. But then the next choice is general chemistry journals like Angewandte Chemie, like the Journal of the American Chemical Society, like Chemical Sciences, and I would add here, of course, also since a few years, Nature Chemistry. Then you go down one more level, coming to the high-quality specialized journals, journals that cover a sub-discipline. These are often also society-owned, and then at the end of the ladder, you have less relevant specialized journal. This is a kind of a filtering mechanism which is very helpful and which probably also exists in other areas. Importance of publishing for us. I think we of course serve in particular two purposes. One, and that is the major purpose, is we provide a service to our members and to the chemical or scientific community in general. But it is, of course, also an important source of income. And you have to find a certain balance, of course, between the two, because on the one hand, the community is only able to sustain a certain prices, whereas on the other hand, we, of course, also have an interest in having resources to finance many of the charitable activities that our society does. One of the things that we do to address this problem is that we have very attractive offerings to our members, and the other learned societies do the same. So for example, starting this year, if you want to have electronic access to one of our journals, you can get that for a flat fee of 99, I think it is, euro. They have to add the tax still, but in Germany that would be then 120 euros. But that certainly is a price which is very attractive. The importance of publication revenues I have listed down here. In our case, that is about 10%. You see the numbers of the RSC and the ACS are much bigger. But I have to say here, in our case, this is only income and there are no expenses because we get royalties. That is, we don't have expenses on this side, whereas, of course, the ACS and the RSC, since they have publishing businesses of their own, even though they get 70% income, they have also a large amount of expenses here. That there still is a significant surplus is a different story. Nevertheless, it shows that publications are an important aspect of what chemical societies do. And of course, we use this to finance many of the activities that we do to address the demands that our members had. And it's easy to see without this income, many of the big societies would indeed be in trouble. Challenges. I don't want to go too much into this subscription prices, library budgets thing. I also don't want to address the peer review aspect, even though that is a very interesting one. We have more and more requests also from our members that say, why should I do peer review without getting anything back from this? And I think we have to start to think about mechanisms to have some kind of appreciation for the work that the reviewers do. And of course, interaction with the commercial publisher, that is a problem that in particular applies for us because we work together with commercial publishers. That is, in most cases, a harmonic thing. But of course, sometimes the interests are different. And that then also leads to some problems, which fortunately up to now we have been able to solve these in an amicable way. But still, the one thing that I want to spend the last 7 or 8 minutes is open access, since this has been a subject here for many, many times already. We started to deal with open access already in 2004. At that time, open access was not a big issue in chemistry. Nevertheless, we have this discussion paper, and I just want to briefly sum up the key messages that we came up with 9 years ago. First of all, you say, yeah, interesting discussion. Then, and that is something that I heard many times today, and I think this is very, very valid and very important, quality assurance through peer review, or if there's a better system than this better system, is an absolute must. Without quality, if the quality is suffering, then this is the wrong way. We also addressed some of the questions in Golden Open Access, which by now I think are all well known. Is it in the benefit of science if not only the scientific quality of your paper decides whether it gets published or not, but in addition you have to have the funds of paying for it? I think this is a question which still has not been answered. Of course, connected to this, availability of funding, we were discussing this just a few minutes ago. Is it the right incentive for publishers, telling them the more you publish, the more revenues you generate? Also, that is a question, I think, which still has not been settled. And, of course, in chemistry in particular, we have the problem of the free riders from the chemical industry. The numbers change. Between 25 and 45% of the revenues in chemistry for publishers are coming from the chemical companies. In a gold open access world, these 25 to 45% would more or less be lost and have to be paid for by others. So in principle, that is subsidization of the chemical industry by public funds. So taxpayers paying for this. In that paper, we also mentioned a certain sympathy for green open access, saying that the author at some point in time has to have or get back the right to decide to do with his paper whatever he wants. But at the end, we did not generate a position. Therefore, it's called discussion paper, not position paper. So there's no final yes or no. Now, in 2013, open access is still not a big issue in chemistry. Nevertheless, we set up a new committee to update the 2004 position, and some of the members of this committee are sitting here in the room. And most of the members of this committee, so this is not representative, this is just sort of what we heard in the discussions. We met twice up to now, and the discussion is not yet over. They say, open access, we don't have an access problem. That, of course, applies to the people we are asking here. It's not, so this is the German situation. They also value the system that we have, which is well functioning. They also don't see open access to a general public as a real critical point, which I absolutely understand. If I think of the papers that I wrote when I was still active in science, I have great doubts whether whether a single paper of these, I don't know how many it were, is of interest to someone who's not in the field. So maybe not even of interest to a chemist who is far away from the field, let alone the man on the street. The paying for publications as in Golden Access is seen by the scientists I was asking as a great annoyance, because they say, I have enough time, or I have enough to do to write a paper and do the research. Now I have to fight to get the funds for paying for it. And this is something they just don't want to, and they don't see the motivation for doing it. And of course, I don't know who it was this morning who spoke about that this is sort of a cost-neutral change. I don't think this is true, because the reallocation of funds that is necessary is so complicated and will, of course, lead to new fights. Can you name a library director who says, oh, fine, I give you all my budget so that you can pay your authors now with that? I think this will create many troubles in the institutions, in the countries, and, of course, internationally. A little bit a different point of view is coming from the chemical industry. For reasons which are obvious, it's not so much that they save the money. It's not so much this. It's more that they say, if we have an open access environment, text mining becomes easier, because the licensing is different. And that, I think, is at the core of the sympathy. I said, open access is not relevant in chemistry. Just to prove that, I came across a study of Harnad et al. From last year, where he looked at uptake of open access in the different disciplines. Chemistry is by far the lowest, with 9%. The average of all disciplines was 23, with then math was 42 as one of the at the upper end. Physics was 27, still fairly good. The hybrid option, which we offer in all our journals, is being used, as you see here, the numbers from 2011 for Angewandte Chemie, 1.3%. So that's 24 papers out of almost 2,000. And I've seen numbers from the Royal Society of Chemistry, which are very, very similar. I also told you that we launched our journal, Gold Road Open Access Journal, Chemistry Open, in 2012, which actually is the first society-backed open access journal in chemistry. But I would not say that this experiment is a very successful experiment. As you see, up to now, we only have 34 published contributions, and only 9 of these 34 paid the author charges, which is fully understandable. Why should a author submit a paper to a new journal, which has no reputation as of yet, and then, on top of this, pay for this, if there are many other journals, high-reputation journals, well-established journals around, where you don't have to pay? You must be crazy, or you must have a very strong mandate for doing this. Again, the comparison with physics. Our sister society in physics already launched in 1998, together with the British Physics Society, the New Journal of Physics, which is also a Golden Access journal, which by now has established itself, has a high impact factor. It was highly subsidized in the beginning, but by now it is financially sustainable. And this shows that the communities are really different when it comes to open access. So I'm almost at the end, so if you give me another 3 or 4 minutes, I will speak a little bit about why we nevertheless have to deal with this, because mandates, and we heard about this morning very much in detail, mandates from policymakers make this also now an issue in chemistry. While it is clear, also this has already been mentioned, in the current period, which is a transition period, we don't see any consequences of this. There might even be slightly increasing revenues due to this double dipping problem, which indeed is a problem, I know that. But nevertheless, in longer terms, we have very great concerns where this will lead us to, because it is a market. And also Golden Road Open Access is a market, and the competition will be not anymore on the reputation and the quality of the journal, as it is now, but it will be on costs. That means that those journals which are highly selective, high quality, and which, for example, if you remember Angewandte Chemie, from five articles which are submissions that are refereed, four are rejected. So the one article that is being published has to pay for the other four as well, which means that these higher quality journals necessarily will have, in a complete golden access, golden open access world, higher author charges. But then again, if the institutions only have limited money for paying this, that means that the high-level journals are the ones who will probably suffer most from this. And again, I doubt whether this is in the interest of science. Someone has called this the race to the bottom, and I think this is a very nice expression for this, because it really leads to these kind of cheap journals. And we this morning heard about this Sage open offer of $99 for an open access paper, which I think is completely stupid and cannot be done. But nevertheless, it goes this direction, and I'm very concerned about this. The green options we already discussed today, and there's nothing really new that I can add to this. Of course, the one thing is green only survives if the traditional way survives, because if there are no subscription-based papers published, there's nothing that you can put in repositories. So it really depends very much on how to find a balance that the green open access does not harm the existing traditional subscription-based publication business. And that, of course, has something to do with the embargo period. We heard about this already. It has something to do with the tools that are becoming available to search and maybe even filter the repositories. If you find everything that you need in a sort of quality hierarchy through electronic means, like some kind of modern science, Google or so, then of course the advantage of the journals is also endangered. And it depends now on the other side whether we are able to create extra features which are not available in the repositories, but only in the published journals. So that is something that still is, I think, very much under debate, and we just have to be very careful also here. So I'm coming to the end. I don't think that open access only, be it gold open access, where I see the big obstacles for high-quality premium journals, where I see the problem for the scientists to suddenly fight within their institution for the limited funds for getting author charges, or in the green way, when all the other disadvantages I was just mentioning a second ago. Therefore, I think an open access only way is not in the interest of science. And the reason why we are there anyway is because all these decisions are made in a top-down approach. It is the politicians who tell us scientists what is good for science. And frankly, I don't think that this is the right way. It is, as I said before, most dangerous for publishers of high-quality journals. Therefore, it's most dangerous for us. And I have great concerns for the future if suddenly we are stripped off of a significant part of our revenues that we will not be able to raise otherwise, probably, which will, of course, then be of big disadvantage to the community if suddenly we are not able, as we do now, to give hundreds of travel grants per year to students, or we will not be able to organize many scientific meetings in the quality that we are doing now, because just the funding is no longer there, and we, of course, cannot charge our members 1,000 euro or so as membership fee. So that is really something that we have to consider in this discussion, and I hope that this is not sort of being accepted as a collateral damage to the change into an open access world, even though sometimes I have the feeling that politicians think like this. Maybe I should almost stop here and just saying you very briefly what can we do. Of course, we need to be compliant. If the politicians say you have to do this, we have to do it, but we have to find ways of dealing with it. We have to strengthen our brands. We have to make, to tell our community what the problems are and that it is also in their interest to keep high-quality journals alive, even though if that means a certain amount of inconvenience for them. We need to work on new tools. We need to work also on new products or journals to just remain on track when it comes to the demands of the community. And this is sort of the agenda that I see for my society, which I also see for all our sister societies who are affected likewise. So, this is now really my last transparency. I hope that I was able to show you that scientific publishing is an important activity of learned societies from the very early days of the learned societies, that it's mostly seen and done as a service to the community, a service to our members, but of course it also is an important source of income, which again then translates into other services to our members. High quality is something that I think from learned societies has a certain or is important for learned societies. I won't compare it now to the commercial publishers, but inherently a learned society has a quality. The quality criterion is important for it. And all this, of course, is challenged by the developments that we see now in the open access movement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions or reactions to this? I can imagine there are.
Hi there. My name is Crispin Taylor. I play a similar role to yours at the American Society of Plant Biologists. One observation, early in your talk, you stated that the journals initially were not there to create revenues for the society. They were there to disseminate knowledge and to allow members to gain credit for the work they were doing. And I've come to think that the business model that we've all evolved, or many of us have evolved to embrace, is actually not the right one. And we do need to find ways to make our revenues equivalent for publishing. So the journals cost as much as we take in. Which means we have to change. We have to change the way we make money and do new things, as your previous slide just showed. I think another of your key questions or statements was that in a gold open access market, there'll be a race to the bottom and cost will be the only factor that's driving author choice as to which journal they submit their work to. But I wonder if that's really true, because there's cost and there's value. And you pointed out, and this is the same is true in plant biology, that society published journals tend to have higher impact factors than commercially published journals, broadly speaking. And Adam Tickle said earlier that there's value in having his faculty publish in higher impact journals. It feeds back to the university in important ways. So I wonder if there isn't still some impetus for paying higher costs for the best quality journals just because they're higher quality.
Well, actually, I don't disagree with that. If I said it will be only cost, that was certainly an exaggeration. There will be scientists who still value the high quality that certain journals offer. No question about this. And if you are, say, a well-distinguished scientist whose funding is rock solid, has lots of money, then probably this person then also has the liberty of saying, okay, I pay twice as much and go into a high-level journal than paying $99 to go for a mediocre journal. But this does not apply to everyone. Whereas today, we have a different situation in that it is absolutely independent from who you are, or in an ideal world, absolutely independent might not be completely true, but in principle, it is independent of who you are, where you are, what kind of reputation you have. It only depends on the quality of your article that you submit, whether you get accepted by Science, Nature, Angewandte Chemie, or whoever. And that is the change. And I think that then, of course, also because there will be not enough money in most of the institutions, we also heard that this morning, to pay for all the golden access, open access requests that the authors of that institution might have. So you will have a fight there for this money. And of course, it is easier for a scientist then to apply for, say, $2,000 or euro than for $4,000. And I think these are the mechanisms then which will, even though the scientist may not like this, that may force him to go down this quality, this race to the bottom. I see it as a risk. I don't say it will necessarily be like this, and from one day to the other, all the high-quality journals will disappear. But it will make life harder for them as compared to the more mediocre journals.
Any other questions or comments?
I'm Alexander Grossman. I'm a physicist myself, and I'm wondering, maybe you could a little bit comment on this, why chemists are usually not adopting this system of preprint servers. Is there a special reason?
I'm not a sociologist, so I can only speculate. I think it has something to do with that there is no tradition of early sharing of results, that there is this common knowledge that your data may be more than just the data you have produced, but that there might be some other consequences connected to it. That again has something to do with the commercial aspects of it. And yeah, see, that already is what I can say to this, because it is absolutely a fact that there is this big difference, in particular if you look at physics on the one hand and chemistry on the other hand. It's always said chemists are more conservative, but that only translates the question into another dimension. Why are they more conservative? I think it's also because the speed with which information is being distributed was in chemistry never as crucial as, for example, in physics. But I know that all these explanations are not very solid. So if someone else has a better explanation, it's highly welcome.
Thank you.
We are actually